Good morning. My name is Vincent Morsher, Deputy Attorney General, representing Appellant, Cross Appellate, Department of Human Services, Wheat Ridge Regional Center. May it please the court. This appeal was brought because the Department of Human Services was blindsided by a State Personnel Board's sua sponte ruling to hold the department accountable for a non-existent rule. The board's order required that the department pay 6 months back pay to two employees whose termination for patient abuse and cover-up of the abuse was affirmed by the ALJ and the board. Because the board lacked legal authority for reversing the ALJ on the issue of the Rule 610 compliance, the order must be reversed. The board should also reverse because it violated the Administrative Procedures Act by imposing a new requirement on all state agencies without undertaking the rulemaking process. The board brief cites to the case of Department Administration versus State Personnel Board for the proposition that the board has wide discretion to interpret a rule. However, that case is distinguished from the incident matter because in that situation, the board interpreted a specific phrase of the rule, the phrase being, he shall meet with the employee involved. Here, there are no words to be interpreted by the board because there is no language in Rule 610 governing notice of a 610 meeting. Okay. The rule is completely silent.
I'm sorry, Mr. Morsher. Yes. If that, and you argue that in your brief as well, if there is no rule directly saying what notice is required, and I understand your argument, why doesn't the board have authority to kind of fill in or interpret? I mean, it talks about some notice required by the appointing authority. In other sections, it talks about notice that has to be given in advance, and I'm going to ask your colleague about that. But if, as you say, there's no real rule saying what's the definition of notice, why doesn't the board have the authority to fill that in?
Well, the board has authority to fill it in if they went through rulemaking and made it official, but it's reasonable notice, and we believe in this situation the department used reasonable notice in notifying the parties, number one, by calling them on the phone a week before, number two, by reading the entire rule at the beginning of the meeting, giving them an opportunity to request another meeting or proceed or not. However, the problem is that the department lacks notice from the board exactly what they were supposed to do. If the rule said that you must send a letter certified in advance to let the parties know all of their rights in Rule 610, then the department wouldn't have gone forward with it because they would have been violating a rule on point. Here, there's no rule on point, and the problem is, after the fact, the board interprets the rule to say, no, you must have sent some kind of notice, including language saying that you have all these rights in the meeting. And since you violated it, you're now liable for back pay. It's just not fair to all the departments to have to comply with something that they don't know in advance what they're supposed to do. It's really an after the fact result that the board.
Well, the rule does say that they are to be advised that they have a right to have a representative present. And that is the kind of advice that one might want to have before the hearing, so one can arrange for that. And it seems to me that's the part of the rule, that it is a stated part of the rule, that was violated. Are you suggesting that the board cannot impose any sanctions for that violation?
Well, I think I don't think there was a violation because they did advise the parties at the beginning of the meeting that they have a right to a representative. And there's nothing in the rule that says that you need to provide that information prior to the meeting. The meeting is not a hearing. It's not anything formal other than a time to talk about what the issues are. And so for the employee to be told at the beginning of the meeting, read Rule 610, which the department did, and get an opportunity to say, you know, I'd rather not proceed.
So your suggestion is that the notice is sufficient if it's given at the beginning of the meeting? The entire notice is sufficient?
I believe it is sufficient.
So if I were discharging you, I could say, would you step into my office a minute? And you would step into my office, and I would start reading the rule to you. That's sufficient?
I think based on the way the rule is written now, I think it is sufficient. I think the department...
That's certainly not the practice, is it?
I'm sorry?
That's certainly not the practice of the agencies under the rule.
It's not the general practice. Every agency does it differently because the rule is not specific on how you do it. And so some agencies, they may send an email. They may send an email without the rule in it saying we're having a 610 meeting on this day, and the other argument I made is that an employee has an obligation to know and understand the rules that govern their employment, including Rule 610. So prior to the meeting, when an employee is told a week before a meeting, we have a 6:10 meeting scheduled, you need to come in for it on this date and time, that employee has an obligation to go and look at Rule 6:10 and see what the rule requires. I mean, there's a specific board rule on that burden to put on the employee.
Can I ask you, Mr. Morsher, I guess I'm a little confused, or not, I shouldn't say confused, I'm not quite sure whether you're arguing the rule is ambiguous or not. I mean, it seems to me, or there's an argument, and again, I'm going to ask your colleague about this, 610A says when reasonable attempts to hold the meeting fail, the appointing authority must send written notice. 610, the first paragraph, doesn't say anything about written notice. It seems that you could make one of two arguments, so I'm not sure which one you're making. You could say the rule is unambiguous, and it says when you have to give written notice, and we're not in that situation. You could also say the rule is ambiguous, and it's unclear. Which position are you taking?
Well, first of all, I think 610A applies to a completely different situation, when the employee won't even show up to a meeting, when they're not responding, when there's no response whatsoever. That gives the agency a chance to send out a letter stating, here are the issues I'm going to look at to impose discipline. You may send the response back. So 610A, I don't think, has anything to do with what we're talking about here. I'm not saying the rule is ambiguous. I'm just saying the rule is silent on that issue, and best practices of the agency come up when it's silent on that. Certainly the board could put in a rule that the agency must send notice of a 6:10 meeting, and the notice must include A, B, C, and D. But as I argued in my brief, there's all kinds of things. How much notice is appropriate? I mean, is it 6 months? Is it 6 minutes? Is it email? Is it a telephone call?
Seem to be saying that it's okay if I advise you when I take you into my office. That's sufficient. So there is no time notice.
I would argue that sometimes does happen, and under the rule, I think that is appropriate. I think it's unfortunate. I think it's not. It certainly doesn't give the employee a sufficient opportunity to be prepared if you do it on the fly like that. But that's not the case here. The case here is they were told a week in advance what the meeting that they were going to have the meeting. They certainly knew the subject matter of the meeting. I mean, they were interviewed by the sheriff's department. They were interviewed by their investigator for the department. These are serious allegations that they knew that they were facing. I mean, patient abuse is not a light situation. So I believe that under the situation, the notice here that the department gave was sufficient. But you're right, Judge. I would agree with you that an employer could bring you in that afternoon and say, we're going to have a 6:10 meeting, and the employee certainly would have a good argument later on to say it wasn't unfair. But since they have an obligation to know and understand the rules, they should know what their rights are for that rule, for this meeting.
Mr. Marshall, it seems to me you may be conflating two separate issues, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding this right. There's what the rule says. And the rule says when considering discipline, the appointing authority must meet and give X information, which would certainly suggest you give information when you meet, and it's part of an overall scheme because then there's all these requirements for due process that happen after, including the full evidentiary hearing we had here. That's one argument. What does the rule say? Then there's a separate issue of due process and Loudermill and all those cases and what they provide. I mean, it maybe we need to separate these issues out. In terms of the rule, I guess there's a pretty good argument here. The rule says you can meet, you can disclose information when you meet. Yeah, that's what unless the attempts to meet have failed, then you got to send written notice. That's a rule issue. Then there's a due process issue. And so, can I ask you, in terms of just the rule, does the rule require, is your position that the rule does not require advance notice at all, except when you couldn't sit at the meeting?
That is my position. As the rule is written, it says absolutely nothing about advance notice of the meeting. But, I mean, it's best practice. I think it's a good idea to do it. Certainly, we advise the agencies to give advance notice and let them know the subject of the meeting. But in this situation, I think the department went above and beyond what is required specifically by the rule.
There's no general notice provision in the board's rules? When notice is required 5 days, there's no general provision.
For specific situations, there is. But I mean, it's directly on point to whatever the rule is addressing. There's no general rule that says you shall always have X amount of notice. I mean, it's there's nothing that says that. I believe I covered most of the points I wanted to cover on this subject. Unless you have any other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Fine.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Judy Labuda. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General, registration number 22130, and I represent the State Personnel Board. Mr. Chouhani and I have just determined that I will take 7 minutes, given the nature of the questions. My argument today will be limited to the due process and rulemaking issues. The department's challenge to the board's ruling fails in three primary areas, which I shall first identify and then address individually. First, the department misconstrues and misconceives the due process requirements in pre-termination proceedings, incorrectly stating that the notice which procedural due process requires is notice only after a 6-10 meeting. Second, the department erroneously asserts the board engaged in unlawful rulemaking, an argument that mistakenly relies on its inaccurate belief that due process that is required is that which the board or state statute conditions as procedure prior to deprivation rather than the Constitution. And to the extent, third, that the board rule provides process beyond that which is due under the 14th Amendment and the Colorado Constitution, but is not inconsistent with either. The board's interpretation of its own rule is entitled to great weight and should not be disturbed upon review unless it is plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the rule itself. On the first issue, Your Honors, there is a wide body of Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court case law that finds that the root requirement of due process is an opportunity for notice and a hearing before deprivation of property interests. The department's argument in its reply brief that only notice and procedural due process is required after disciplinary action is imposed is an argument that is both misplaced and which fails to recognize the long-standing holdings that notice and an opportunity to respond in a meaningful way are required in pre-termination hearings.
Now, if I can ask you, Ms. Labuda, on this, Loudermill, as you well know, Chris says it's a flexible process. You just kind of have to give them a heads up. There's case law, a case out of the Seventh Circuit called Staples, that said contemporary notice at the meeting could satisfy due process. So I guess I'm wondering whether you're saying the rule is void on its face as an issue of due process. And secondly, I'd be curious, in an as-applied challenge, why there's a problem here. Oral notice was given to both of the employees. Both of them showed up at the meeting and they're asked right at the beginning, you know why you're here. They both said yes. They're told about the representation. Ms. Berriman, as I recall it, didn't really respond but didn't ask for representative. And Ms. Adams says, didn't know that, doesn't matter, let's go. Where's the due process problem in this case?
I think there's several due process problems, Your Honor. First, the record does not actually show that Ms. Berman or Ms. Adams were notified that there was a 6-10 meeting. The record shows that Mr. Gunn talked with Ms. Berman, left a message for Ms. Adams saying there would be a meeting. Ms. Berman and Ms. Adams testified they thought the meeting would be with their supervisor, Ms. Aguilar, and Mr. Gunn.
Well, they said that later. The ALJ found that Mr. Gunn called about a pre-disciplinary meeting, and I haven't seen a challenge to that factual finding here.
Your Honor, I think that the ALJ found that a notice of a meeting was given. And there is evidence in the record that Mr. Gunn himself said that he only had contact with Ms. Stauffer when he was wondering why the investigation was going so long, because he needed his employees to get back to work. And that in itself shows that Mr. Gunn was not necessarily thinking that this meeting could have been a 6-10 meeting at that point in time. But even given that, Your Honor, these employees had a right to be noticed on what the issues were. If you look at the Burry case, this court found that that notice of a pre-termination was a letter that stated, we are looking at whether or not you have provided competent civil service, and we're going to address the issues of October 15th, 1993, and whether you exercised good judgment in that situation, and whether or not you followed department procedures. That's proper notice. Berman and Adams were not given any notice of what the issues were for the meeting that they were entering on January 5th.
And in addition, how do you respond, though, on the first question at the 6-10 meeting was, do you understand why you're here? And they both said yes. Well, really? That they had, there was an investigation, they were interviewed, and By the way, the ALJ found them both not credible on their testimony, various of their testimony. I'm confused how you could say they had no idea what this meeting was about when they said they understood it and they had all been both been interviewed before about this incident.
Your Honor, I think that in the line of cases that starts out with Moline and goes through Matthews and Arnett and on to Loudermill and the Goldberg cases, that those line of cases all say that the notice and the opportunity to respond has to be meaningful. In this case, we know that they didn't get notice that it was a 6:10 meeting. They didn't get the written letter. They didn't have an identification of what the issues were. In fact, Ms. Stauffer interviewed Ms. Berman on the 21st, at which point Ms. Berman drafted a new statement, and the record shows that Ms. Stauffer spoke with her supervisor and made a decision not to inform Ms. Adams prior to the January 5th meeting of the fact that Ms. Berman had a new statement. Ms. Adams could not have known what the intent of the meeting was when she didn't have that information. They didn't have a meaningful opportunity to respond. And when they entered that room, and they were with not their supervisor, but their supervisor's boss and their supervisor's boss's boss, to say that they now have the opportunity to determine that they want to stop the meeting is not realistic. They're in a place of intimidation. They've been called into a meeting. They thought that they were going to be looking at going back to work and wrapping things up. So I don't think under the whole line of cases of Matthews and Loudermill and Arnett that they had due process. And I think that the appellant in this case has adopted the bitter with the sweet approach that was the dissent in Arnett. We have a constitutionally created board that created a rule. And that rule requires that they have an opportunity to have a representative. The department argues that they didn't know whether they should have 6 minutes or 6 months that they give notice of the meeting. That in itself defies due process. Due process is flexible.
So is your position Rule 610 is void on its face?
No, Your Honor. I think that the board has the ability to interpret its own rules, and that's what I think it did.
But how do you get there? And I don't mean to keep interrupting you. I know you got 7 minutes. So how do you get there when 610A specifically talks about when the authority has to send a written notice? I mean, whoever wrote the rule knew how to say when written advance notice was required, and it doesn't say that about this.
Your Honor, I think that federal minimum due process protections require notice, and the department does not get to alleviate its responsibility to provide due process under the 14th Amendment and provide notice simply because there's a board rule that's silent on whether notice is required. And with that, I think I need to turn over to Mr. Schwani, unless you have any questions you would prefer I answer. Thank you, Your Honor.
The bailiff restore to 9 minutes. The clock for the second argument and add a minute to the appellant's time. You now have your 9 minutes, sir.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. It's wonderful. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mark Schwani, and I represent Maria Berman and Don Adams in this matter. I won't go into any further detail on the procedural due process argument that Ms. Labuda has already argued. We share her position on the issue. I will add one other piece to it, though, and that goes to the opportunity to be heard. Due process clearly requires not only notice, but an opportunity to be heard prior to the deprivation of the property interest. In this case, the facts clearly point out that the department made a decision 2 weeks prior to the predisciplinary meeting that they would go ahead and terminate Ms. Berman and Ms. Adams.
Didn't the ALJ specifically reject this argument? Mr. Gunn testified, I made the decision, and the ALJ credited that.
The facts clearly pointed out, though, that Ms. Stauffer, the department investigator, said prior to the Jefferson County Sheriff's deputy that we are going to terminate those individuals. She clearly stated in testimony, the sheriff's deputy stated in testimony that Ms. Stauffer stated she had the authority to terminate them. She then goes to the Director of Programming Services, Ken Kaiser, who sits in on the predisciplinary meeting. Prior to the predisciplinary meeting, She says they had a discussion where they discussed termination and make a decision there.
Let me ask again. Didn't the ALJ specifically reject this argument?
Yes, she did.
All right. And wasn't there evidence that, I understand the evidence you presented, but wasn't there contrary evidence, most notably Mr. Gunn's testimony, I made the decision? And if there was such contrary evidence, how can we overturn the ALJ's fact-finding?
I think her fact-finding was arbitrary and capricious. I think that there's clear testimony from credible witnesses, that being the sheriff's deputy and from Ms. Stouffer herself, that the issue was discussed. And the decision was made 2 weeks prior.
Is there any indication that Mr. Gunn was in those meetings?
None, Your Honor. Which would change the situation, I believe. If Mr. Gunn had been part of these discussions, if he had said to the sheriff's deputy, I'm considering, I have the authority to terminate them, and I believe I will terminate them, becomes a much more difficult case, I think, for my clients. Ms. Stouffer is an individual who has no authority, and it sort of flies in the face of procedural due process and the opportunity to be heard. If a decision is predetermined prior to that opportunity to be heard. And what I think is important in the board's decision as far as the procedural due process issue is they awarded the 6 months of back pay up to the date of the actual administrative hearing. In a sense, they're saying you didn't get your process until that first day of the administrative hearing. And so that award is a proper award to answer this deprivation of a due process right.
Isn't it fairly common for the administrator or the appointing authority to have made up their mind about what the discipline's going to be before this meeting starts? Or is this a meeting in which it is somewhat litigated in front of him, so he then makes a decision?
I think that goes to the core of what procedural due process is that, in a sense, no determination is made about termination until that opportunity be heard. It's a meaningless opportunity if the decision is already made.
Doesn't Loudermill does say that it's just kind of an initial gut check and it's a chance to exchange information. What information did your clients not have the chance to say at that meeting? They both told their stories at length.
Yes, they did, but it's our contention that the decision was already made. They could have said a whole range of things, and it wouldn't have mattered. I think Board Rule 610 also addresses this, because it clearly states this is an opportunity for employees to respond to the allegations to them. If the decision is already made, there's no point in really responding, and it's not a legitimate opportunity. Second, in our cross appeal, we argue the issue of the admission of hearsay evidence into the record. Admitting the hearsay statements, the administrative judge so relaxed the evidentiary rules concerning the admission of hearsay as to disregard the due process of law, and we argue that's based on three reasons. First, the regional center failed to demonstrate the client one and client two's disabilities rendered them unavailable pursuant to Colorado Rule of Evidence 804A4. Second, the regional center failed to provide sufficient indicia of reliability and trustworthiness as to the claims that Berman and Adams abused client one. Finally, there was no discussion about the use of affirmative measures that could have made client one available for testimony.
Do the rules apply with equal vigor in administrative hearings and trials and courts?
I would say they do. I think the case law is, the distinction is usually drawn between criminal cases where there's the confrontation clause and civil cases. Now, granted, the Administrative Procedures Act says there's some flexibility, as far as the ALJ has, in allowing evidence in, but that's only to an extent where when it begins to infringe on the due process rights that becomes more questionable. And I think the cases in Kirk and Flowers go directly to that issue.
Well, counsel, given that it wasn't any error in admitting this hearsay evidence harmless in because Ms. Berumen's written statement was consistent with what client one and client two were supposed to have said?
We would argue that her statement was not consistent with that. We argue at hearing that her statement was largely drafted and redrafted by the investigator.
Nevertheless, she signed it. So why isn't that? Yes, that's an admission of a party opponent. Why doesn't that take this whole hearsay issue out of the case?
Her statement was simply that there had been an incident where they had to de-escalate client one. She never admitted and never stated that he was injured, that he was placed in an inappropriate hold, or that he
She did in her oral statement, though, correct? She admitted that he was injured in her oral statement.
No, it's our contention that she did not.
Is the problem that they restrained the client, or the problem is that they injured the client?
Well, I believe the department would argue that they restrained the client in a method that was inappropriate, and that constituted, in a legal sense, abuse. It's our contention that, especially with client one, who's, according to his behavior program, his baseline was 25 aggressive behaviors a month, that he constantly needed control because of these aggressive behaviors. Our contention is that they applied and properly de-escalated the situation, and that it wasn't a situation where he was injured. It was clear, based on the standard shift change check of the clients, that both Ms. Adams and then the second shift staff, Ms. Whitmore, reviewed client one and found no injuries on him. What's particularly troublesome about this case is the injury doesn't get discovered on first shift, Ms. Adams and Ms. Berumen's. It gets discovered on second shift. And all the evidence is contradictory to the argument of the department that the injury happened on first shift.
I don't see how you can say that. I mean, we had a statement from client two as to what happened that was viewed as credited. Client one then said, here's what happened, and, you know, it seems to me you're arguing the facts again, but the ALJ found against you on these facts, and there was evidence to support the contrary. I understand you had evidence on your side too, but isn't that for the ALJ to decide?
I see I'm out of time.
You can answer my question, please. Thank you.
I think this goes back to the flower stop standard. If we had an opportunity to cross-examine client two, it's a much different case. If we cross-examine, the judge takes the statement as client two said, then we lose the case. But we lost our opportunity to cross-examine, and we had no meaningful due process. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure, I think you have 8 minutes, but I don't know. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. In response to my colleague at the AG's office argument that they were not provided with notice that the meeting was going to be a 6-10 meeting, I'll refer you to the ALJ's opinion, paragraphs 116 and 117, where the ALJ specifically found that they were provided notice that it was a 6-10 meeting or a predisciplinary meeting. Going to the last argument that was made by counsel about the hearsay issue, in counsel's own admission, client one had 25 aggressive outbursts a month, and I think the judge, in her discretion, made a reasonable decision that this is not someone who can be brought into a courtroom and be required to testify. That's one of the factors under Flower Stop that she looked at as to whether the person is available as a witness. So I think that saying that they should have been in court and should have been cross-examined would have helped flesh out the issues, I disagree. As you mentioned, Judge Gabriel, that it was corroborated, or Judge Roy, I'm sorry, that it was corroborated by Judge Terry.
Somebody up here said something.
What I was going to say is that it was corroborated by a written and a verbal statement by Ms. Berumen. Additionally, Ms. Terry, at the end of her shift, told another coworker that they had to restrain one of the clients today. And so the testimony from that other employee verified that something did happen, that something did occur. So I think the judge, in her discretion, and especially under her the relaxed standards of evidence under the APA, under the specific board rule that allows the judge to go beyond, loosen up the rules, to so to speak, on evidence, she was able to look at those factors and accept that information, especially in collaboration with Ms. Berumen and Ms. Terry.
You mean Ms. Adams?
I'm sorry.
I don't think I'm in this case.
I need to stay away from names today. As far as the predetermination issue goes, counsel stated that if Mr. Dunn was in those meetings, was in the meeting with the officer, was in the meeting, the management meeting where this was discussed, that it would be a harder case. I think it would be a much easier case for them because the appointing authority, the person who makes the decision, would have been exposed to the direct opinions of people of how he should decide in this. And I think the fact that he was not in that management meeting, the fact that he was not meeting with the sheriff and with the investigator, Ms. Stopfer, it shows that he was kept away from the process. He did his own determination of the facts and was able to make his decision after the 6:10 meeting, as is required to do. So he went into that 6:10 meeting without having his mind made up, without having talked to anybody else about what the decision should be, and he listened to what they had to offer as mitigating information, as required under the rule, and then he made his decision. So there was no predetermination here. The opinion that Ms. Stopfer had when she was talking to the sheriff, when they discussed that, that was in the context of whether or not criminal charges should be filed. As a result of the discussion that they'll probably be fired, they decided not to file criminal charges, feeling that, well, if they're going to be fired, then we're not going to go down this road and charge them criminally. That was really the context of that conversation, but Mr. Gutter knew nothing about that. In fact, in the police report where that's discussed, Mr. Gutter testified here that he didn't even look at that police report. So it shows that he was not under the influence of anyone else's statements at the department that he should decide that termination is the best approach. Additionally, his supervisor, Mr. Kaiser, he testified that and when asked the question at hearing whether he would have reversed the decision Mr. Gunn made or had an opinion about that, Mr. Kaiser said he would have accepted it, he would have counseled him that this is not what we normally do, but he would have accepted it because Mr. Gunn was the appointing authority. So I think it's clear all across the board that Mr. Gunn was the one who made the decision that wasn't influenced by any other factors.
And we actually don't need to decide factually what happened. We just need to say whether there was evidence supporting the ALJ's finding on that. Is that correct?
And that's correct. And I think the record here is there's abundant support in the record for what the board decided in this case, which was affirming the ALJ, that there is substantial evidence in the record supporting that there was no predetermination, that the hearsay the statements by the other witnesses were appropriate, and I don't think counsel has pointed out any evidence in the record that counters that. Unless the court has any other questions, I am done with my argument.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.